Good morning, everybody, and I will start recording as well. There we go. And welcome to week three of our planned five-part series on the biblical battlefields of Israel. We talked first about Jericho, Jericho, and we started last week to talk about Ayalon, the war, very different kind of a war that the Jews fought to defend a Canaanite tribe from other tribes. We started the story last week. We talked about the halting of the sun and the moon a little bit. So what I want to do this week is complete our look at Ayalon, at the battlefield itself, where it took place, and the miracle of the halting of the sun and the moon, and what we're supposed to take from that. And then start on the third stop on our tour, which is Kishon, Wadi Kishon. And that's a different kind of war yet again. Our first war was a war of conquest. Our second war is a war of defense. Our third war is going to be a war of revolt against Canaanites who are oppressing us. So we're seeing, you know, different types of battle as well as different scenes of battlefields and different miracles. So what we said last week regarding Ayalon was just a matter of context. We said the Jews have at this stage entered into the land that had been called Canaan, that is going to become Israel. The Jews at this stage, I'm just going to put the link again for the source sheet in the chat. The Jews at this stage have demonstrated military prowess. The Canaanites are concerned. They are rallying to fight the Jews as one group, even though they're all different tribes. See that? Jews can create unity, not necessarily among ourselves, but, you know, it's a start. And there's this one group, though, a group called the Chivi, who are not interested in buying into that plan. They, their king bought into that plan, but the people, not interested. They live in a place called Giv'on, and they send delegates to the Jews, pretending to be coming from far away, saying that we would like to make a peace deal with you. We're not of these Canaanites who you already tried to sue for peace unsuccessfully. We want to make a deal with you. And the Jews, without apparently consulting God, accept the offer and say, okay, we're going to live at peace with you. And then they find out they've been tricked. However, they decide we're going to agree to the pact with you anyway, because there's a great concern that in the event that they don't stick to the deal, not everyone is going to realize that the deal was a product of fraud, that they were in fact tricked, and that would create big, big problems. You don't want to appear like a nation that doesn't keep its word, and therefore they make the deal with Giv'on. Well, in chapter 10 of Joshua, the Canaanites hear about this, and they attack Giv'on. And we talked a little bit last time about why they attack Giv'on. Why do they attack one of their own at this point? What are their motivations? We're going to come back to that in a little bit when we talk about the battlefield itself, where they fight them. But Giv'on sends a message to the Jews and says, hey, we need help. We're in trouble. Do something. And the Jews rally to their support and come in to defend them. And God joins the battle as well. That's what we're up to at this point. If you have the source sheet, which, you know, the link for it is there in the chat. We pick up with the first source there, which is from Joshua chapter 10. And God supporting the battle that the Jews fight on behalf of Giv'on. As I said in the email that I sent out on Sunday, or Monday, whenever it was, I want to dedicate our learning this morning in memory of those who died in Meron, as well as for a refuah shlema, a complete and speedy recovery for those who were injured. So, taking a look at source number one. The Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid of them, meaning these assembled Canaanite tribes, for I will deliver them into your hands. Not one of them shall withstand you. Well, Joshua took them by surprise, marching all night from Gilgal. We talked about that last time. Were they fighting at night or just marching through the night? The Lord threw them into a panic, and I added in there the original Hebrew word from the text for reasons that we'll come back to. Vayihumim. The Lord threw them into a panic before Israel. Joshua inflicted a crushing defeat on them at Gibeon, pursued them in the direction of the Beit Horon ascent, and harried them all the way to Azekah and Makedah. Yeah, it's very interesting. In the U.S., I don't know if it's also true in Canada, but in the U.S., you see a lot of places that are named for biblical sites. They all over the place. So some of them are very obvious, like Bethlehem. But some of them, you don't necessarily know about or realize. So when I was living in Pennsylvania, there was where I lived called Makeda Road. Macada. It took me a very long time to realize that that was named for this. Makeda in this story. But in any case, Joshua pursues them to Beit Horon, all the way to Azekah, to Makedah. While they were fleeing before Israel down the descent from Beit Horon, because up one side, down the other, the Lord hurled huge stones on them from the sky, all the way to Azekah, and they perished, more perished from the hailstones than were killed by the Israelite weapons. On that occasion, when the Lord routed the Amorites before the Israelites, Joshua addressed the Lord. He said in the presence of the Israelites, "Stand still, O sun, at Gibeon, O moon, in the valley of Ayalon." And the sun stood still, and the moon halted, while a nation wreaked judgment on its foes, as is written in the book of Yashar. We're going to come back to that in a moment. Thus the sun halted in mid-heaven, did not press on to set for a whole day, for the Lord fought for Israel. Neither before nor since has there ever been such a day when the Lord acted on words spoken by a man. So there's an awful lot philosophically that we could spend time discussing. None of us are particularly comfortable with the idea of mass death. And the fact that this is the solution here is, the death of the Canaanites, understood, taken as given, but not something that we're going to be able to explore right now. Also, the question of why are there miracles in a biblical war, but we don't get them today, right? Why in Meron weren't they saved miraculously? Again, an important discussion. Also, not what we're going to be able to take care of in studying the battle today. What we see here is that God chooses to get involved, whether it's because the Jews swore a pact in the name of God, or because God wants to demonstrate that he is supporting them even after they made the deal with the people of Gibeon without consulting him. And Joshua requests a miracle. He asks God, it appears, to extend support for their battle by extending daylight. That's the simple explanation. We talked about the possibility of fighting at night last time, but I think the simple read really is that God is that Joshua is calling on God for support to enable this. Clear? Okay, that brings us back, up to speed. We understand what's going on in the story relatively. Okay. So, a couple of notes here. First of all, when we read the article about the eclipse, right, the suggestion that this was an eclipse, so I think the text noted that the Hebrew doesn't say stand still when Joshua talks to the sun and the moon, right? The Hebrew, shemesh begivon dome, v'yareach be'emek ayalon, that's the Hebrew. The word dome, as a verb, does not mean stand still. It actually means, anybody know? What does dome usually mean?
Silence.
Silence, exactly. After Aaron's two sons, Nadav and Avihu, die, vayidom Aharon. Exactly. So it means silence. So have you ever heard of the concept of the music of the spheres? Or the music of the heavens? You familiar with that? There's this idea that when the celestial bodies, the planets, the stars, whatever, are operating in the heavens, and when they're moving around in their orbits, that is considered to be music. It's like they are singing. And in Tanakh, in biblical context, they're singing praise to God. So he's telling them to be silent, meaning to stop their normal function. That's the idea. And he also says he wants the moon to halt, which is odd, right? Why do you need the moon to halt? You need the sun to halt because you want light. Why do you need to ask for the moon to halt? What's that about? What would you say?
Because it would be dark all the time. He doesn't want darkness.
Well, no. If the sun stops, you have light. Why does he need the moon to stop?
Because we're rotating around them, around the sun, and the moon is at the same time. So when the sun goes down, the moon comes up.
Right. So Eti is along the lines of Don Isaac Abarbanel. Don Isaac Abarbanel, writing at the end of the 15th century, said that Joshua doesn't want to ask too much. He's already asking for the sun to halt. The structure of the heavens is such that the moon and the sun operate in tandem. So the moon is going to have to halt if the sun halts, because he doesn't want to ask for a total alteration of what's going on in the heavens. Now, from a modern astronomical understanding, none of this can happen from a scientific perspective. Obviously, this is talking about something supernatural. There's no way that this happens in the normal course of affairs. But in a hypothetical universe in which the Earth stops revolving around the sun, so one of two things happens to the moon, right? Either the moon keeps on going around the Earth, or the moon flies off into space somewhere because, the moon still has its own motion. It has its own momentum. But the moon doesn't need to halt. But Don Isaac Abarbanel, you understand, is more than 500 years ago. The textbooks look a little different. And so he says, we don't want to maximize the miracle that we are expecting from God. And therefore, if you're going to halt the sun, you also halt the moon. He also brings another idea. That's of interest. Another side note of interest that I wanted to point out is that we're told it is written in the Book of Yashar. Any ideas for what the Book of Yashar might be? What does Yashar mean in Hebrew?
Straight.
Straight. So the Book of Straight. What does that mean? So the way that Abarbanel, Don Isaac Abarbanel, explained it is that the Torah is the book of the straight. It's the book that gives us role models for living a straight life and for being a yashar person, a righteous person. The Torah commands us to be yashar, to be righteous. So it's a reference to the Torah and how the Torah describes that God has the power to change the heavens miraculously. Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, on the other hand, writing in the 14th century, says no. He says there are other books that existed historically that we just don't have anymore. There was a book called the Book of the Right, the Book of the Straight, however you want to translate the word Yashar, and we just don't have it anymore. Okay. The messages that we get from this story, and then we're going to look at the battlefield and the miracle, but the messages that we get from this story, I think are several. Well, you tell me. I've been basically monologuing, for the last 15 minutes. So what messages are we supposed to take from this story? Yes, Eti.
God is with Joshua and the people of Israel.
God is with Joshua and the people of Israel. That's definitely one. God says, I am willing to help, right? As is emphasized at the end of the excerpt I brought you, where God acted on words spoken by a human being. That's something that is remarkable. Moish. You're muted. You got to unmute.
Let me try something exactly the opposite. Okay. thinking about the stars. Just to step back for a second to your analysis of the eclipse, I think that it's possible to easily understand it in an eclipse, but that's not the issue here. If it is understandable to Israel, to the people in Israel who are knowledgeable, the other, the opposing enemies would have no idea. So then it would look as, I think that Yehoshua had his words broadcast. In other words, you know, passed around by spies, just taught the word around to the other side, and they got really, really scared. They can control, wait a second, it's not that they can control the sun, they can control the day. They're controlling the sun and the moon, suddenly we're into the next day.
So that's it's a fun idea. I'm going to, if you don't mind, poke a couple of holes, though.
Sure. I just made it up.
I like the best of your ideas. The Moshe and I exchange a lot of emails about ideas. This was not intended as an insult. A couple of issues here. Number one, I still don't buy the eclipse explanation. Yes, there were arguments made in favor last week, but I'm still not buying it. But also, the Jews at this stage have been out of Egypt for 70 years. It is an entirely new generation. To think that they're working with Egyptian astronomy, I don't know. I have a, actually not, it's not 70 years. Sorry, that's not correct. That's, it's 40 years. I was at the other end of Joshua's period. That's, yeah. But it's, nonetheless, it's a whole new generation. I'm not sold. Possible? Don't know. I'm gonna throw out two other ideas here for what messages we're supposed to take from here. I think we're supposed to draw the importance of honor. You made an agreement, you stick to it, and even at great peril, right? You are now putting yourself in danger to fight the assembled might of what are effectively the kings of northern Canaan, all rallied against you in a battle you didn't need. It's a battle to defend Givon. And even though the agreement you entered was a result of ignoring God's advice. So so nonetheless, you have to hold up your end of a deal that you made. And that's what God is supporting here by supporting them in the battle. That's a second message that I see here is the importance of honor. And then the third point that I see here would be in terms of the language that I highlighted for you in the Hebrew. The word that I put in the Hebrew, when it said the Lord threw them into a panic, vayihu mem, so take a look at source number two, please. Source number two is actually important to us for two reasons. We'll see them in order. These are two verses from, as you see, Exodus, from when the Jews are leaving Egypt. The first of them is during the plague of Barad, the plague of hail. So you know the story, right? Hailstones and fire come down from the heavens. It is the which plague? What number plague is it? Someone tell me. You're muted. No, that was good. Number eight.
Yeah.
Right. Diane just said, Barad Arba Choshech Makad Bechorot. Actually, sorry, number seven. You were close. You tricked me too. Barad Arba Choshech Makad Bechorot. So Barad is number seven. So the plague number seven comes down, and Pharaoh comes to Moses, and he says, you got to put a stop to this plague. We can't deal with this. And so Moses steps out of the city and prays to God to stop the plague of hail. But something interesting happens. Take a look at number two. And Moses departed the city from before Pharaoh, and he spread out his hands before God. And the sounds halted, va'kolot yechdalu in the Hebrew, and the hail and rain did not pour earthward. Lonitach Artsa. So what happened to it if it didn't pour earthward? Susan, you're gesturing something. I think I know what you're gesturing, but yeah.
It went up that way.
It didn't say it went up.
No, it said
Yeah.
Or heavenly. I'm just thinking of the...
What other options are there?
It stopped hailing.
So what happened to the hailstones? They're in the middle of the sky.
They returned to where they were?
Didn't say that.
They meant it.
No, it doesn't not say it. So my natural assumption would have been... My natural assumption would have been what Etty said and Moish just said, which is they disappeared. They evaporate. They dematerialize, whatever it is. They're gone. They were falling, and then they stop. However, that's not what the text says. It says they didn't fall earthward. Yes, Esther.
So was it hell until Joshua's time?
So that is what... Shadow? That is what a Midrash suggests. That the hail that God sent... In our story, in Joshua's time, are the hailstones that were just stuck in the atmosphere, right? I read an article last night. There's a Chinese rocket that they used to bring up part of their space station that's going to come down somewhere. We assume the Pacific. We hope the Pacific. So this hail has just been floating around in the atmosphere. And now God says, okay, your turn. Come down and strike the Canaanites here. I'm going to come back to the significance of that midrash in a moment, because I don't think that's just random. It's trying to teach us something. The other piece that I wanted to show you is the second verse in source number two. The second verse in source number two is already later on when the Egyptians are coming after the Jews. It's not enough they enslaved us. It's not enough they tortured us. It's not enough that they threw the babies into the river. We leave Egypt, and they're still coming after us. They want to capture us at the sea, at Yam Suf. So take a look at what the text says. And it was at the morning watch. This is right before going into the sea. And God gazed upon the Egyptian camp in a pillar of fire and cloud. And he panicked the Egyptian camp. He caused panic in their camp. You notice the word in the Hebrew, I put it in the parentheses, vayahom, right? Vayahom, the same as the word that was used for panicking the Canaanites in Joshua's time. The text uses the same word. Why does the text use the same word? It's not a normal word. It's not a word you see an awful lot. What is this meant to teach us? Susan.
Which is quite a different thing. It's not the same. And I'm just wondering, are there many, like, does this shorish, this root, have many different explanations?
Not so much. It really is stronger than confused.
Oh,
which
so right.
Which text are you reading? Which translation is it? The pink book. What you'd have to do is get their translation also for Joshua, but they don't have one. Right? That's when
this is their
that's their Joshua. You'd have to compare what they do in Joshua and what they do in Exodus and see if they do same thing.
Okay, I have this in Exodus.
Okay, so I'm curious to see whether they do confused in both places. Sometimes you see translations that will do one thing in one context, one thing in another, without apparent reason. Sometimes context does affect how you translate a word. But in any case, this word, which is a word we're also going to come back to next week, if I remember correctly, is a really important word, because it's linking the two events, right? Where what we're doing here, by a midrash saying the hail from Egypt is the hail in Canaan, and saying that what God does to the Egyptians is what God does to the Canaanites using the same word, it's trying to teach us something. There's something we're supposed to draw when a connection is made between the battle now and what happened when we got out of Egypt. I'm going to put that message on hold because it's going to come up again in our third battlefield in Kishon, but I think it's a really important message that we're going to have to come back to, so stay tuned. Let's shift gears. We're going to talk now... Susan, it's okay. When we do it in the context of Kishon, you'll tell me about the translation there also, because we're going to see the same word show up again. We're moving now to talk about the battlefield itself. So hopefully everyone has the source sheet, because I put a map on there that I drew off of Google Maps. Not I drew, like drawing, that I took off of Google Maps. It's not a great map on my printout because I'm working with a black and white printer. Hopefully it's a little bit clearer on yours. But in the center of the map, you should see the Latrun junction. And you should be able, that's where, essentially, where Ayalon is. Can you see it on your map? Because my printout really isn't very good. You can see it on yours. Okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to share, oh, you printed it in color. That's the way to do it. I'm going to share the screen with the source sheet on it. There you go. And you can see the red part there, that red arrow, is for the Latrun Junction. So, orienting it on the map in general, you can see you're a little north of Jerusalem. However, you are much closer to the sea. You're centered. This keeps trying to give me a map description. But you can see what we're talking about in terms of where this is. This region in general that it's in, the region in the middle of the country, is an area called the Shefela. Shefela means a low-lying area. Shafal is to be low in a variety of ways. And what happens is, in terms of the topography of the land of Israel, you have hills that are just off of the shore of the Mediterranean. And then, as you move away from the Mediterranean, you get a low-lying area as you go east. And then you get the Judean hills, Hare Yehuda. So this is a low-lying area between the hills on one side, the hills on the other. If you're familiar with Israeli geography, the area just north of the Ayalon Valley is the area that we mentioned in Joshua, Beit Horon. Today there's a Beit Horon junction there. The area at the southern end is the Latrun junction. Okay? So that's a little bit of the geography, and I'll now explain why this matters. Valleys in Tanakh are generally places of battle. In scripture, when you see a valley, think war. That's the way it works. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, we get the first great biblical war. The war between the 4 kings and the 5 kings. Massive showdown. This is when Abraham is going to get involved. He has no horse in this race, so to speak, except that his brother-in-law Lot is taken captive and he has to go free him. So he says, I better get involved. But take a look at source number 4, where I brought you the biblical introduction to that war. Now, when King Amraphel of Shinar, Aryoch, king of Elasar, Kedarlaomer of Elam, Tidal of Goyim, made war against Bera, king of Sidon, Birsha, king of Amorah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shem-Aver, king of Tzvoyim, and the king of Bela, which is Tsoar. So you've got 4 kings going to war against 5 kings. All the latter joined forces where? At the Valley of Sidim, which later becomes known as the Dead Sea. So there is a valley where they fight. Other battles in valleys, if you take a look at source number 5, include, in the book of Judges, the valley of Yisrael, in which Midian and their allies are going to invade Israel in the time of the judge Gideon. The valley of Elah, which I want to talk about as well, that will be in our last week. That's the Philistines attack there. There's another Philistine attack in the valley of Rephaim. Ammon and Moab, 2 tribes living east of the Jordan, invade Israel, and they fight in Emek Bracha, the Valley of Bracha. Over and over again, we see valleys as sites of battle. They're also identified sometimes as places of judgment, which may be associated. But tell me something. This ain't rocket science. Why are valleys a good place for battles? You're assuming that it's one group in the hills and one group in the valleys. Eti, what are you thinking?
Because in the valley,
in the valley, everybody can see each other, so that's why it's a good place or a bad place?
Good place.
Do you want to be out?
Not a good place.
Marilyn thinks not. Could be.
It depends where the other armies are located. If they're up high, it's excellent for them. For those being pursued, it's not so good, like the Khyber Pass. You can't be down below.
So one reason you do your battle in a valley is because it's good for chariots. The chariots do very well there. Now, Jews didn't have chariots. We were never the charioteers. We were the charioted, not the charioteers. People brought their chariots against us, was the way it works, whether it was Canaanites or Philistines or whoever, or the Egyptians, for that matter. The chariots of fire were not our fire. Until Elijah went up in chariot of fire. So Marsh, I see your hand, but I just want to go through this point. Valleys were a good open area for chariots. As a matter of fact, we're going to find out when we talk about Kishon that at that point, the Jews were restricted to living in the mountains because the Canaanites with their chariots controlled the lowlands. So that's one reason for valleys to be in to be places of battle. The other, though, has to do with what I just showed you in terms of the geography and topography of the land of Israel. In order to explain this, I'm going to show you something that you never know how things that you pick up at some stage in your life will become relevant and useful later on. When I was a student in Israel, I had spent a year in university, and then I went to study in Israel for a couple of years. So at the end of my first year, I wanted to come home and bring presents for different family members. So I go into a used bookstore. I'm like, I don't know, 18 years old and don't really know much. But, go into a used bookstore, and I found this that you see here, for those who can read it. If it's a little too hard to read, it's Yisrael Midan Va'ad Eilat. And what it is a set of maps and descriptions of places created by the IDF with researchers of every place around Israel from Dan to Eilat. Dan way up north, Eilat way down south, and it's 4 volumes. So I picked that up for my mom. I thought that she would really like it. So it actually became very useful in preparing this class because they have a nice description of the area that we're talking about, where Ayalon is, and that's what I translated in source number 6 from this fellow Yoshua Levinson writing in this section in the IDF map collection. And what he says is that the Ayalon Valley was strategically important. It's formed along a fault line that runs northeast to southwest. Here, take a look at number 6 at my translation. This is the broadest valley in the northern and southern portions of the Shephelah. So that whole center of the country that I showed you, between the hills that are in the west and the mountains that are in the east, that low-lying area, this is the broadest valley that you have. Its formation was tied to a depression along the length of fault lines, which run from northeast to southwest. A wide valley formed at the very edge of a mountainous area generally draws to it numerous streams from the mountain. These unite to form one big stream, and that's going to help, of course, to deepen the valley. The length, to broaden it, the length of the Ayalon Valley from the area of the Maale Beit Horon Junction, that's at the north end, to the Latrun Junction at the south end is about 10 kilometers. Its width from Mishmar Ayalon to Emmaus is about 4 kilometers. Several of the battles which determined control of the center of the land, and especially the passage by Jerusalem, were held at different times at the roads entering this valley. Even today, the Ayalon Valley serves as an entrance to 2 paths, and he goes on about the different eras and the roads that you would use to access it. There was actually, in the time of the Hasmonean revolt against the Greeks, there was a major battle the Battle of Emmaus that took place at this site. This was always an important battle site because it was strategic. If you wanted to get east, if you wanted to get west, if you wanted to get to Jerusalem, if you wanted to get to the coast, you always had to go through Ayalon. You follow? It isn't just, here's a valley, let's have a battle. Effectively, what it means is, the battle is because of the valley. You follow? It's not the valley because we're having a battle, let's do it in a valley. It's, we're fighting because of the valley. In other words, the Canaanim react so strongly to the people of Gibeon capitulating. We gave reasons last week as to why they react so strongly, because, you know, it's a case of the nation rebelling against its king, or because they were strong, and all of those explanations, those are all valid. However, it's also because Gibeon lives in a really important place. This is the area which the Canaanites feel we have to hold against the Israelites. You follow? This matters to them. It also may explain, then, why God is going to send us a miracle. Because since this site is so important, God wants to make sure that we are going to have a decisive victory there. And therefore, he's going to stop the sun, stop the moon, in order to ensure that we win this battle. You follow? It's not just random valley. This was a really important place. Okay. Moshe, you had your hand up before. Comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a very brief point. I mean, there's so many strategies and tactics in any battle, but the one opening strategy that the Gil gives coming down is a psychological benefit and one of them, momentum. But then on the other hand, it's just like who takes the first move in a chess game and what is...
Right.
What person does next.
Right. No, it's true. And the point about the being at an advantage when you're in the hills can be true, but often doesn't work out that way. Okay. So let's talk about the moon and the sun, and this whole business of them halting. You know, I took it as a given when we first reported the story, when we talked about it last week, that sure, the text in the Bible is telling us the sun stopped and the moon stopped. However that worked, however that happened, however, you know, all the oxygen didn't disappear from Earth and the Earth didn't, you know, whatever. That's what happened. Interestingly, though, we do have commentators who are considered traditional commentators believing in the divinity of the text and so on, who argued that that's not what happened. The sun did not stop. Their objection was not about physical impossibility. How could this be? The answer to that was, just like the flood in the beginning of the Torah, just like creation, God can do whatever God wants. That's easy. Their objection was philosophical. And their answer to it was to explain the miracle differently. And I bring you Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. If you take a look at source number 7, writing in the 14th century, 13th into the 14th, he has 4 objections to the idea that the sun and the moon halted. And I brought you the text here, but actually looking at the time and how much text I brought, I'm going to say it outside of the text. You can see it in the text yourself. Number 1, he says, this would make Joshua equal to or above Moses. Moses does not stop the sun and the moon, and even if he did, that would make Joshua Moses' equal. And he says, first of all, there is actually a passage in the Talmud which talks about Moses halting the sun at one point, but he says, I don't understand why the Torah would have omitted telling us about that. That sort of miracle is something you'd want to write home about. But he also says, since the Torah says no prophet ever arose like Moses, you can't tell me that that's what happened, that Joshua did what Moses did. That's number 1. Objection number 2 is he says, examine the text a little bit more closely. The text says, and if you go back to source number 1, it said, as I wrote it, the sun stood, the moon halted. Thus the sun halted in mid-heaven and did not press on to set for a whole day. Or as I translated it in Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, it did not hasten to set. He says, not hastening to set doesn't have to mean that it halted, he argues. And along with that, he says, the victory is what's miraculous. It was God fighting for the Jews, our victory in the battle, that was miraculous, he says. It's not about the halting of the sun and the moon. He says it didn't halt. His third argument is there was no need for a miracle like that. God does not perform miracles unnecessarily, and he didn't need this. He has other ways that he can defeat them. He says that's not warranted. And finally, he says, and this is a whole discussion in philosophy that starts with the Greeks. He says, this is above Joshua's pay grade. Human beings are not able to appeal to forces that are able to stop nature at that level. The sun and the moon are beyond what a prophet is able to achieve. And so he says, that's not what happened. And if you look at the third page, the top of the page, I'll pick up with what he says did happen. He says, rather, it is clear that this was not the miracle. Rather, Joshua's statement to God was that the battle against their enemies should be completed before the sun would leave Gibeon and the moon would leave the valley of Ayalon. That was it. He was just asking God, let's finish before sundown. The verse was brief in describing this. That's all. Then he says, this may be seen from the verse's comment, and the sun was silent and the moon stood until the nation had gained retribution upon its enemies. Just by the way, if you're wondering about the difference in the translations between source number 7 for the text and source number 1, it's because source number 1 is the JPS translation, whereas source number 7 is my own translation of it when I translated Ralbag. So there are some slight variations. But he says, the verse doesn't mean that they halted. He says it means the sun was silent in Gibeon and the moon in the valley of Ayalon until this was completed, until the battle was completed. This was marvelous. Not only did Joshua, specify that the Jews should successfully gain retribution upon their enemies, but also, he also specified that the victory should occur in a very brief period. That was the miracle. And goes on to explain that's the idea, that the miracle is that God listened and fought on behalf of the Jews. Moish.
Okay, I want to make everybody smile. Because...
Why?
Hold on. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead, Moish.
Okay. Lest you think that this never happened again. It did. In literary. So hold on a second. This entire story, if you accept the Eclipse story, Mark Twain wrote a book called A Connecticut Yankee in
King Arthur's Court, yes.
Which was later made into a great movie with Danny Kaye, but that's another story. But one of the key segments is where Daddy Kay gets to be Mordecai, not just playing through your name, but he gets to be Mordecai by predicting an eclipse. It's exactly, you can easily say this.
So, okay, Moish, I'm going to ask you to hold this until 11:01, because I have until 11, and then you can have 11:01. Thanks. The issue here, according to Ralbag, is that you can't believe philosophically that this was what happened, and therefore he says, don't read it the way that we've always read it, the way the Talmud read it, as the sun and the moon halting. He says that's not actually what is happening. So I thought that was interesting to note. But in terms of the message of the miracle itself, the text emphasizes that God listened to a human being in order to create a miracle. That was what the text said. That's unique and special. Now, the truth of the matter is that we've had other times when prophets requested things from God. In the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, Korach leads a mutiny against Moses, right? And if you remember that story, when Korach leads a mutiny against Moses, Moses says thank you for the corrections in the chat for Moshe on the movie, much appreciated. But I'm really not going to focus on the movie right now. The story with Korach, Moses says, there should be a great miracle that is created. And that's, of course, when Korach is swallowed up in his mutiny. We've had other times when prophets have summoned miracles. But what's special here, as some commentators note, is, yes, it was a command performance, but also the goal of this miracle, and this is suggested by Rabbi Meir Leibush, the commentator known as Malbim, was that Ralbag is correct. God doesn't need this miracle in order to win the war. However, it's highly public. It's something that everybody will be aware of. If the sun and the moon halt, everybody on earth is going to be aware of it. There's a similar idea in the prophet Isaiah in chapters 38 and 39. The sun and the moon halting is something everybody is aware of, and that is what's new here, that God is willing to act on behalf of Joshua to elevate his name before the nations. So I think that that's another message that we're supposed to draw here. I also brought you in source number 8, a source that I'm not going to spend time on reading it aloud, but just to note, the Talmud presents this idea that with other nations, the armies protect the king. With us, the king, God, acts to protect us. And that's what we're seeing here as well. Clear? What, Marilyn? I can't hear you.
God protects us through the army.
In this case, yes. Well, giving the army a miracle to help it, but yes. So, just to sum up what we said here, and I'm rushing a little bit because I was hoping really to start on the Kishon story today as well. I gave you 7 review questions there. Why did the Jews agree to a pact with Givon after being tricked? It was a matter of reputation and honor. They did not want to be seen as violating their agreements. You give your word, you stick to it. Why did the Canaanite kings band together to fight Givon? So now we understand that part of it is they're afraid of the Jews. Part of it is because the people of Givon rejected their own king. Part of it was because they didn't want the Jews to have a foothold. Part of it was that Givon was mighty. But a lot of it is the strategic location. The place in which this is happening, this valley, is very important. The Book of the Righteous, where the miracle is recorded, it's either the Torah or some lost text. What 3 messages does the war provide? The importance of upholding honor, the importance of that God is going to help us, and that the miracle of Egypt is linked here, which is something that I want to come back to when we talk about Kishon. The Valley of Ayalon is important because valleys in general are sites for biblical battle, thanks to their topography, but also because it was a strategic location in the Shephelah. Jewish tradition is not unanimous that the sun and the moon halted, as we saw from Ralbag, and the major mirror message is divine willingness to warp nature on our behalf. Okay, I rushed a little bit, I hope not too much, and now let's get started briefly on Kishon, because we have 10 minutes to talk about that. Is that okay?
Just to let you know, in both places it's confusion.
In both places they translate as confused. Thank you. Okay. So let's talk about Kishon. This is the 3rd battle in our series. It's a battle in which the Jews are being oppressed by their Canaanite neighbors, if you will, and they fight to throw them off. The story occurs in Judges, chapters 4 and 5. I gave you links in source number 9 on the sheet, where those are links to classes that I taught in the series on the Book of Judges, in which I discussed this battle at much greater length. So this story takes place about 150 years after the Jews have already entered the land of Israel. Okay, you have to know that going in. We're now much later than the events we've been reading about so far. I'm going to give you more context soon, but instead of going into the battle and its context, I thought what I would do is just mention the story that immediately precedes this battle and the story that immediately follows it, because those are interesting and important for understanding the story. So the way this story begins is with a woman by the name of Devorah, or Deborah. Take a look, please, at source number 10. This is the introduction to our story of the battle at Kishon. The Israelites again did what was to the Lord. That happens a lot in the book of Judges. Ehud, the previous judge, now being dead, he had already passed away. And the Lord surrendered them to King Yavin of Canaan, who reigned in a place called Hazor. That was his capital. His army commander was a man named Sisera. We're going to see a lot about him, whose base was Haroshet Goyim. The Israelites cried out to the Lord, for he, Sisera, had 900 iron chariots. And he had oppressed Israel ruthlessly for 20 years. That's Yavin, the king, Sisera, the general. They had oppressed the Jews for 20 years. Flip the page, please. Deborah, wife of Lapidot, was a prophetess. She led Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah, between Ramah and Bet-El in the hill country of Ephraim. This is off to the east. And the Israelites would come to her for decisions. She was a judge. So she's prophet and judge. She summoned Barak, son of Abinoam, of Kedesh in Naphtali, and she says to Barak the following. The Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go march up to Mount Tabor. Take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, and I will draw Sisera, Yavin's army commander, with his chariots and his troops toward you up to the Wadi Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hands. Okay, so Devorah says, God has commanded that you should, take 10,000 men, go up to the top of a mountain, and I'm going to give you Sisera, the army commander of Yavin. But Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go. If not, I will not go. Very well, I will go with you, she answered. However, there will be no glory for you in the course you are taking, for then the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. So there. So Devorah went with Barak to Kedesh. So, just as a side note, when it says Eshet Lapidot in the Hebrew, here they translate it as wife of Lapidot. So that translation is difficult. The reason it's difficult is because the way the text presents it, if Lapidot were really her husband, it would have to be somebody we knew. When you say Devorah, wife of Lapidot, it sounds like we're supposed to know who Lapidot is. And we don't know of anyone named Lapidot at all in all of Scripture. So some suggest that it's meant to describe her. And Don Isaac Abarbanel says the word lapidot is taken in its literal meaning. What is a lapid? Anybody know? Linda, you're gesturing, but you're muted.
A torch.
A torch, yeah. A lapid is a torch. So that Don Isaac Abarbanel says it means a woman of fire. When it says Devorah is Eshet Lapidot, it means not wife of Lapidot, it's a woman of fire. And that plays out. You can see it in the part that I brought here where Barak says to her, I'm not going if you don't go with me. And her reaction is, okay, fine, but then your enemy is going to fall to a woman. See how you like that? You're not getting any glory out of it. The response is very much a response of fire, and that will play out throughout Judges chapter 4 and chapter 5. I gave a short class about her in source number 11. You see the link a few years ago, and I think it's worth a listen. So that's the story right before the battle. And then I want to show you the story. Yes, Ethi.
In Hebrew,
So, number one, we play games with masculine and feminine in terms of singular and plural all the time. So, Nair is a candle, but the plural of Nair is?
Nerot,
not Nerim. So, you know, in terms of tying it down to being Lapidim or Lapidot, I think that's an interesting question. But number two, all the explanations for this, whether you take the view that it's saying it's her husband, whether it's that she is, a woman of fire, or any of the explanations, all of them have challenges. Another explanation that's offered in some commentaries is that she made torches for the temple. That she used to prepare the wicks for the flames, but those aren't called lapidot usually. Those are called nerot. So that's hard. Okay. I thought I saw another hand about this. Okay. So I'm just going to show you quickly the end of the battle. That was the beginning of the battle. Now take a look at the end of the battle in source number 3. Not number 3, excuse me. Source number 12. Number 12. This is the end of the battle. Sisera, the Canaanite general, is fleeing for reasons we'll talk about. Sisera, meanwhile, had fled on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Chever the Cainite, for there was friendship between King Yavin of Chazor and the family of Chever the Cainite. We'll talk about that next week. Yael came out to greet Sisera and said to him, "Come in, my lord. Come in here. Do not be afraid." So he entered her tent. She covered him with a blanket. Note, from the sources, it seems like she's not Jewish. She's just a helpful person. She says to Sisera, "Come into the tent." She covers him with a blanket. He said to her, "Please let me have some water. I'm thirsty." She opened a skin of milk and gave him some to drink. And she covered him again. He said to her, "Stand at the entrance of the tent. If anybody comes and asks you if there is anybody here, say no." Right? Because he's running away from a battle that his forces are losing. Then Yael, wife of Chever, took a tent pin and grasped the mallet. When he was fast asleep from exhaustion, she approached him stealthily and drove the pin through his temple till it went down to the ground. Thus he died. When it says pin, you think of like this little thin nothing. It's a tent peg. It's a spike, right? If you have a tent, and not like a tent that you use when you go camping overnight, but that your family lives in, this is a spike, not a pin. She takes the spike, she puts it on his temple, she takes the mallet, and she smashes down, and it goes through his skull to the ground. Now Barak appeared in pursuit of Sisera, right? Up comes Barak, huffing and puffing, running after Sisera. Yael went out to greet him and said, "Come, I'll show you the man you are looking for." He went inside with her, and there Sisera was, lying dead, with the spike in his temple. So there's an awful lot to say about this part of the story also, this piece with Yael. Also, the influence of her story, if you're familiar with the story of Judith, right? There's an apocryphal story of Judith. It's not in Tanakh. It's in an added book called the Book of Judith, which has Judith doing something similar, beheading an enemy general named Holofernes. And getting him to sleep, and there are versions of that story that involve her using dairy, just like there's dairy here. There's a lot to be said linking the two stories. But if you take a look at source number 13, there's a link for a short class I gave about Yael, as I call her the accidental assassin. But what we're going to talk about next week is what happens between these two stories. What happened after Devorah took Barak into war? And before Sisera got killed. And that's going to be the story of the battle in Kishon. Okay? So, God willing, that will be next week. This week I ended up talking a lot more than usual. I hope that that next week I'll be less monologuish. But, thank you. So I'll stay on for another few minutes like usual, and thank you very, very much for participating.
You.